Hello and welcome back to Family Law, A Case for Children. I am pleased you have returned. For those of you ladies listening in the UK, I do hope you were spoiled rotten by your partners and children on Mothering Sunday. Do feel sorry for me. I wasn't spoiled, as all my children were away from home. Enough of the self-pity though. Let's move on to children in the Norman era. The next two episodes, we will take a look at unnatural deaths in infants. We will place the unnatural deaths into three categories: overlaying, infanticide, and filicide. Before we move on to each individual category, we will have a brief look at how child death was treated pre-Christianity. In 380 AD, the Roman Empire adopted Christianity as their legal religion. As we know, the empire's influence was far-reaching. As a result, Christianity spread throughout Western Europe. In the non-Judeo-Christian culture of the day, the immortal soul of those who believed in such a thing, they did not believe it resided in an infant or a child from the moment of conception. And as a result, any form of infant death was not considered murder. In both Roman and barbarian tribes, now I do like the definition of barbarian. It states that it's any foreigner who did not have Greek or Roman traditions. It goes to show how much emphasis we put on the rightness, if there is such a word, of our own cultural norms. Anyway, let's move on. So in both the Roman and barbarian tribes, newborn babies were placed before their fathers. If he picked the child up, it was deemed as part of the family. If the family was on the brink of starvation, or the child was deformed, or in some cases if the child was female, the infant would be abandoned or to die of exposure. The treatment of unwanted children was not a reflection of how they treated their other children. The Cambridge Romans in Focus has two brilliant examples of this. A tombstone of Claudia Victoria in first century AD, that is. The inscription on the monument set up by her mother read, "In memory of Claudia Victoria, who died at the age of 10 years old, 1 month and 11 days." It shows the affection, you know, she knew up to the day how old that child was, and it was important enough to make a monument out of the fact that she died to remember her. While there was a letter dated around 1 BC, written by a man to a woman, possibly his wife or his daughter or a sister, and it read, "If good luck to you, you bear a child. If it is a male, let him live. If it's a female, expose it." And that expose it, leave it to the elements, to exposure for death. It goes to show the other end of the spectrum. From this, we can conclude that although children were loved, they could just easily be discarded. So by the 4th century, many of Western Europe, most of the barbarians, like I mentioned earlier, were converted to Christianity. And under the influence of the church, the attitude towards the death of infants, by extension children, began to change. With the introduction of Christianity, we have children being baptized shortly after birth, giving them an identity and a place in society. Now, if you are a tad bit cynical, you could argue it was because they could acquire property and work for the benefit of another. That's only if you're cynical. Anyway, the new status of the infant or the child did not automatically change with the conversion of Christianity. Issues concerning infanticide were normally punished by the ecclesiastical courts. It wasn't until 1623 where Parliament passed into law an act which stated an act for the murdering of bastard children. Here we can see the act refers to a specific form of infanticide. With the Christian influence over time, the idea of the killing of a child or an unwanted infant was to be seen as horrific. What is paradoxical here, though, is although the murdering of an infant was seen as grave and worthy of punishment, it was also pardonable, very frequently so. Here we can see the Christian ideology of mercy and forgiveness of sin at play. Today, we will look at the first of our categories, overlaying. Overlaying occurred when a child would be in the bed of their parents, and that parent could accidentally lay on the infant and smother him or her. The mother would normally be seen as the culprit. The church saw this as accidental death due to parental negligence. The church, that is, the ecclesiastical court, would normally deal with such cases. The issue here is that there was no way of telling if the smothering was negligent or purposeful, and all smothering was treated as, by the church, as negligent parenting. In the ecclesiastic court, the punishment for any form of infanticide was more lenient than if one accidentally killed an adult. Because the punishment was dispensed by the church, it would be in the form of penance, which could be temporary, public, or it might even be humiliating. The canonist frequently warned against mothers sleeping in bed with their children. Though in 1224 it was stated, under the threat of excommunication from the church, women should restrain from keeping their children close by in bed, lest they smother them whilst in sleep. This shows that they were aware of the dangers to the children, thus the preventative approach. Some cases would be before the royal courts, because all deaths, even accidental ones, had to be reported according to common law. Now, this was not a duty they would easily shirk, as it would be one would be fined for neglecting their duty. So as long as a child's body was found, it would be reported. So at common law in the royal courts, infanticide could be tried as homicide. Here, the juror were called on to determine if it was deliberate suffocation. In cases of suffocation, even when the mother fled after death, the jury would consider the death accidental. Where the body of the baby was no longer in the family home, examples, so there is an example of a mother who threw the body in a vineyard and fled. She tried to conceal the death, and that concealment would be an indicator of her guilt. There was a presumption of guilt when one fled, when one hid the body and fled, unless innocence could be proved by one witness. But the crux here, what caused a major problem, was the concealment of the body. With both the royal courts and the ecclesiastic courts, although the death was seen as awful, it did not fall into the category of heinous. In more cases than not, even when the alleged perpetrator fled, the death would be considered accidental. What is surprising here is the number of cases involving infanticide. Between 1265 and 1413, as published by Selden Society, there were no infanticides in the coroner's rolls. In Norfolk, Northamptonshire, and Yorkshire, from 1300 to 1348, of the 2,933 homicide cases, only one case of infanticide appeared. The question which arises is, was statute or ecclesiastical law proportionate to the prevention of overlaying or deliberate suffocation? And were necessary steps taken for the welfare of the children? With one case of infanticide before the court in 48 years, the resounding response would be no. A positive argument can be put forward on behalf of the ecclesiastical courts. Excommunication in a medieval society was handing a person over to the devil. The individual would be cut off from the church's sacrament and from most contact with other Christians. In a society that was highly devout, one could argue this would be an appropriate form of punishment. The individual would be on the outskirts, not fully being able to participate in society. That in itself is a form of imprisonment. Royal courts determining that trying to conceal the body of a child is a presumption of guilt unless the innocence could be proved by one other witness could also be an argument in favor of proportionality to the offense. However, the crux of the matter here is, was that sufficient a punishment for the death of a vulnerable child? When we consider that during that era, the stigma that arose from pregnancy out of wedlock, and the fact that out of the 2,933 homicides, only one was a case of infanticide, it begs the question, were the steps taken actually beneficial at any point to the welfare of the children? Therefore, were the necessary steps taken? The conclusion here would be no. When considering the punishment, the number of cases brought before the court, and that most cases were dealt with by the ecclesiastical court, and the number of pardons issued, it can easily be argued that there was a case to be answered. And this is quite evident, as it was not until 1623 when statute was implemented to deal with infanticide. But even then, it was specifically aimed at bastard children, children born out of wedlock. Therefore, children who died where their parents were married did not fall within that category. Would a reasonable, responsible adult not notice that the voices of these infants were being silenced? Where were the vanguards? Please do join me next week as we continue Family Law, A Case for Children, looking at unnatural deaths of children in the Norman era. Take care. Bye.